out of product because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us because what we say is in them is in them because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9 384643.
Back at the races, and Rich Migliori standing by. And Rich, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Give me an excuse to come in from the barn. It's a little cold this morning.
I was just going to say, knowing what we got up here, and it's just a dusting, but it's enough. It had to be, it's all you got to clean the snow off of stuff, chip the ice off the buckets, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was doing. I was just knocking off ice off the bucket. So, and I still got some stalls to muck, but I'm like halfway through. But this was a welcome reprieve from being out there.
Well, and we got a few ways to go and talk about this wrap up to the. It's kind of funny. It just taking a little bit of a. A pause here, essentially, a 10-day holiday break, which is good for everybody. The horsemen, the horses, everybody gets a little bit of a chance to reset.
Oh, absolutely. You know, for years, we would race all the way till, Christmas Eve. I mean, I remember winning a race for Dennis Ryder on Christmas Eve, and I wasn't doing that well. I was struggling a little bit. He was struggling a little bit. And it was like, yes, this made Christmas. The horse's name was Miraculously. It went well named. and what, wound up a nice Christmas for all of us because of Miraculously.
I love it. And, I started the show kind of touching on the schedule. And there's a mixed bag here of who's racing, and of course California essentially off for 2 weeks leading up to the 26th, and even that you had arrived already, right? I mean, when was that first period that you went out to California?
Well, so I was out there 2006. I started riding at Hollywood Park. And then I came home for Christmas, and I had to leave Christmas night to head back, so I was with the family Christmas Day, but then 4:30 in the afternoon, I had to leave to go back. And I got to be honest with you, I felt so bad. I thought, leaving your family on Christmas Day, it just was like, I needed to get back and get, ready. And actually then I won the, I guess it was the Sir Beaufort then. They had obviously the other stakes, but the Sir Beaufort was a mile on the turf, and I rode Kip DeVille for Rick Dutrow. Michelle Nevin actually was out there with that string of horses he had sent out there, and had gone over to Hollywood Park to work him. And man, the first time I worked him, he was rank. I mean, really rank. Run, kind of a runoff, I guess Garrett Gomez had worked in the previous, and Ron Anderson had both of us, and he could ride something else. And I don't think Garrett particularly cared for him because he was kind of at the time a runoff. And then I worked him, and he was, you know, rank. I worked him back. He was a little better. And then I worked him right before I went home for Christmas. And, like, you know, wow, I'm kind of, you know, we're getting along. We're figuring this out. And he got an inside post. And I remember going to the paddock and talking to Michelle, saying, I'd like to try to cover him up. And, you know, she's a good horsewoman. You know, she understands the game. And she's like, I agree with you. But if he gets away from you once you're covered up, like, you know, that's how guys get dropped. You know, you get on a horse that decides he's not going to have any part of rating, and you're in behind, you know, a bunch of horses. So I said, well, I'll play it off the break. If I feel like I have him, you know, I'll cover him up. And if not, I'll just put my hands down and let him do what he does. And I thought I had him, Steve. And after we went about an eighth of a mile going into the first turn, man, he locked on the bit, and now I'm running off, and I got no place to go.
Hmm.
And he got his head up in my lap, and it's such a crazy thing, and like people that have, you know, never had the privilege of experiencing this adrenaline rush, if you keep the horse's head up in the air trying to slow him down more, if they clip heels, then they will fall 100% of the time. So even though everything inside of you is screaming, pull harder to slow them down, you actually have to give them their head so that they can see the heels in front of them. They'll still clip them, you know, a horse like that, but at least you kind of almost leave them to their own devices. Like if you ever watch foals in the field, they jump on each other and clip heels, and you know, but they've got control of their feet. So I pitched his head, and man, I go, here we go. This could get really ugly. And he clipped heels with the horse in front of us, but he was able to see it, and he was an athlete, and it kind of backed him off the bit. And then I had him, and he settled in the pocket, and then he went on and won the Sir Beaufort. So it was a great way, you know, my first foray out there to California to start it. So that was December of 06. Then the next year I had to leave again on Christmas Day in 07, but actually Joseph came out with me. So that kind of took a little bit of the sting out, like, you know, at least me and Joey flew out together, and he was out with me at the track and stuff. But that's a racetracker's life, you know. You live your life around the racing calendar, and, you know, you kind of accept it. The thing I used to do, Steve, and I can admit it now, I hated riding around Christmas when we went all the way to Christmas Eve, and I hated having to go to Aqueduct the day after Christmas because you had to watch your weight. You know, you couldn't really eat Christmas Day.
Sure.
I would always have somebody that I, you know, had a little beef with that had, you know, shut me off in a race. And I would tell them, listen, today's the day I'm going to get even, a week or two before Christmas. And I would get even and get suspended. And then people couldn't be mad at me. You know, you're saying, what, you're not going to ride the day after Christmas? Oh, I want to ride your horse, but I got suspended. Yeah, okay.
Oh, there's a little inside baseball. There it is. That's very big of you to. Has that admission seen the light of day before?
Not as public a forum as yours.
That's pretty funny.
I had a long memory, Steve. I'd go, hey, remember that race in July, opening week in Saratoga?
Ridiculous.
Remember that? Today's the day.
Unbelievable. I could tell a terrible joke, but I won't, actually. How about this? For those of you that have jokes in your head cataloged, the punchline is, today's the day. That's an old classic.
Well, today's the day.
Today's the day. Rich, talk a little bit about the weekend, actually, and the last few days of racing. And I was kind of on the move all weekend, so I really did not see any of the shows at all. I was betting and watching on you know, on the phone and on the laptop. Actually, I want to talk about tomorrow. I've tried to reach out to Uriah St. Louis, who never responds. when you text him, he'll pick up the phone. We may talk to him later. He's making this a habit, Rich, and I don't understand why that horse had to be 42-1. That didn't make any sense yesterday.
No, he was too big a price. There's no doubt about that. And you know, particularly the way the track was yesterday, you know, it was a track that was, you know, really dull and tiring. Yeah. And if, you know, you've got, things could heat up, like, you know, at least this is a horse that can come pick up the pieces. And I think that's when you see your big upsets, you know, when people aren't maybe going in so much with the idea of, hey, we're going to win, but hey, we can get a good piece of this. And they take their time and you know, let things kind of play out in front of them. You know, I go back to Friends Lake in the Florida Derby. I was riding to get a check. You know, I really thought that he was a little up against it, and if I rode him really well and came running, he'd get a good piece of it, not necessarily win it. And you know, then you watch, you know, guys in front of you starting to make early moves, and frankly, making some mistakes here and there. And you go, okay, great, I'm going to get a piece of it. And then, you know, you wind up getting a big piece of it. It feels a little bit like that to me. But, you know, he said something in the post-race, how well the horse had, you know, trained for the race before they made the decision that they were definitely coming for it. The horse breezed at Parks, and he breezed phenomenally. And it's right there in the form. I mean, 47-2, you know, I mean, it wasn't like it was hidden anywhere. So, you know, I thought that was kind of interesting.
He's just, you know, piling up these wins. It's very funny. And I mean, it's certainly this horse, when you look at the last two efforts, he was absolutely a fit in here. That's what was amazing. I you know, for him to go at you know, 40-1, and there was like a huge, it wasn't as if there was, in fact, I want to pull out the chart. It was not as if there was a series of prices leading up. There was a concentration. I mean, Mystic Knight, who frankly seemed to be tailing off, was even money. But then you had You're to Blame 5-1, Bourbonic 6-1, Empty Tomb 8-1, and then 11, 1290, 1280, and 19. And then all of a sudden, I mean, he was like the complete outlier, 42-1. I suppose that Haddock plays into this too, the jock, Dexter Haddock. As being,
well, I got to tell you know what was impressive about him? Like, you know, and this, I remember being a kid and getting in a position where you had a chance to shine and getting, you know, excited, right? Like you wanted to show you can compete at this level. And, you know, you're riding in New York, you want to showcase what you can do. And you would have a tendency to override. I mean, I know when I rode Wild again in the Meadowlands Cup, I overrode him. You know, I it was a big race and I was, you know, my first grade one, and, you know, you're 20 years old and you know, 19 years old, and you ride like, you know, you're the Pony Express, right? And you're being chased. He stayed so cool. He really delivered a really cool, kind of thoughtful, polished ride. I mean, the last five jumps, I could see he got up into his toes and his heels came up because it was like he realized I'm going to win it. But up until about four or five strides before the wire, he could not have delivered a more calm, collected ride. I mean, I really was impressed with that.
Dexter Haddock, and forewarned, the Ohio bred, for Uriah St. Louis. Actually, Chris Griffin responded on Twitter with a snippet of St. Louis talking about going to that vocational school to be a pilot in near Ozone Park. And usually he tells the story about how, you know, because he was a track athlete, how he would run back and forth from the school to Aqueduct. That usually works its way into the story.
That's great. It's a great story. You know, and like, I know they ship their horses around themselves. Like, they do, you know, it's a real you know, I don't want to say mom and pop because maybe that's not right, or I don't know, maybe it is, but you know, they're hands on. They do a lot of all the work themselves, and so you know, I get a kick out of it, like thinking about them driving back to parks, like you know. Like, I wonder, do they ever stop at, like, Gargiulio's? And, you know, but they got a horse with them, so I guess they can't. Yeah.
Now, we hopefully we'll talk to Uriah, and it's amazing. It helps trigger a carryover for when the racing returns on the 30th. Couple of other spots we should include, Rich. And I actually just heard from Samantha Siegel. I reached out to congratulate Samantha on Happy Medium, who won that allowance race on Saturday. And clearly, and I understand Michelle Nevin is going to take her time and is not going to, you know, just, you know, feed Happy Medium to the stake wolves right now. Is going to, you know, build up steadily. But that was super impressive. And in fact, an argument could be made that it was the biggest performance anywhere of the weekend.
I agree. I've been impressed with him to begin with, but then, you know, to kind of, he keeps, to me, taking steps forward. He may not have run any faster than, you know, his previous big buyer figure, but he did it easier. And I love that Michelle takes the tack that she does, where, no, we're just going to take our time. We're not in a big hurry. That's how you really develop horses. You know, the old school horsemen used to win races with horses, and it's always been my contention that a horse only has so many A efforts in them. And you don't want to use those A efforts in spots where they don't need them. You know, so if I can win with a horse four or five times without going to the bottom of the well with B and C efforts, when he needs that effort in a grade one or in tougher company, it's still in there. You know, if great horses have more, you know, A efforts in them. But I still think that there's an inventory of them in every horse. You know, lesser horses have less of those A efforts in them. They're not going to go to the bottom of the well as often as good horses. That's why it's a trainer's job not just to have them conditioned well, but to spot them to make it as easy as possible on them, and that they have those in reserve when they really need them. You know, I remember when Hook and Ladder and Trippy hooked up in the Gulfstream Park Sprint Stakes, and they went a half and 43-3, and they were at each other's throat latch every step of the way, and Hook and Ladder got the better of them. Neither horse was ever the same. It was a shame that wasn't the Breeders' Cup Sprint that day, because they ran an incredible buyer figure. They ran fast. It was 7-8. After that, they both won races, but neither one of them wanted a dogfight again. I remember being on Hook and Ladder and somebody getting to me, and if like I had to squeeze him early, he'd almost get hard underneath you and pin his ears, like, I'm not going back to that place. So I think that what Michelle's doing is definitely a throwback to that, where, you know what? I say it on the show, Steve. They knew Mike Tyson was going to be champion of the world when he was 15, 16 years old. Didn't mean he started fighting the top contenders right away. They built him into it. They kept building him physically, mentally. And I love when I see a trainer do that with horses. I think you get so much more out of them going forward. And the horse's efficiency of his stride is what really makes him stand out. Watch his mechanics. Just watch how easily he goes fast. Tony Black, how they're going fast. Going fast comes easily to him because of the mechanics of his stride.
It's on that, you know, on that topic, there's a conversation probably to be had, and you can riff on it a little bit. When you talk about that kind of a gut-busting effort, the race that always comes to mind for me is Read the Footnotes and 2nd of June in that Fountain of Youth.
Yes.
And there's no doubt, and we certainly talked about it with Rick Violette later on, that, you know, Read the Footnotes was never the same. And he only had two starts afterward, the Florida Derby and the Kentucky Derby. But that was not the race that you wanted your horse to have as a off the layoff first start back off the Remsen win that, to end his two-year-old campaign. And, and 2nd of June went on to, some decent efforts. But that was just, that was one of the more amazing things I've ever seen, the two of them. And, you juxtapose it, because I'm going to slip in Carl Nafsker, and Carl's feeling like that Tampa Bay Derby that Street Sense had with Any Given Saturday, Carl was thrilled with that. He thought that was, just what the horse needed. So I don't know if it's a question of foundation or how much, how much you've tightened the screws before a layoff race like this, like either one of these had. One horse, moved forward off that effort, meaning Street Sense, and read the footnotes, it went the other way ultimately. I mean, what is the difference maker? And frankly, Rich, you can't stop a good horse from competing in that setting, right? I mean, if you're going to have a throwdown, you're not going to wrap up on your horse and not let him compete.
Oh no, not at all. I mean, that's first of all, that's your job. I mean, you could lose your license if you didn't, right? I mean, you have to, allow your horse to run. But so Carl felt that tougher race on him set him up for what was to come. That's what I'm garnering,
yes,
from what you said.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh yeah.
Okay, but he was prepared for that effort. Meaning, everything's in increments. Everything's in steps. Like we're talking about Michelle Nevin now with Happy Medium. It's taking one step at a time. He's now primed to take another step up, not jumping into the deep end of the pool. I guess maybe that's the best way I can explain it. I think that, taking that tact where a horse kind of, makes those baby steps, and not even baby steps, just the logical order of moving forward off of efforts and not, jumping in where you're in a knockdown, drag out street fight every step of the way. Am I explaining?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like Tyson, right? He sparred with, good journeymen, sparred with better journeymen, fought, guys that were, adequate, fought guys, probably that were tomato cans early, then fought guys that were better. So every time you step up to the next challenge, you're prepared for that challenge. I love listening to Steve Asmussen talk about preparing horses for races and how it's his job. He always talks about his responsibility to have them prepared for what they're going to face out there. You're not going to throw them out there unprepared for the challenge they have to meet that particular day. But that doesn't mean you have them primed to win a maiden race and give a grade one effort. This is something that every week I get on my soapbox about something. Back in the 80s, and particularly when I came around, most stables had their main jockey. Like Georgie Velasquez was strong with Calumet and Green Tree, Darby Dan. Angel was strong with his guys. I was, with Mr. Tomorrow. And Jeffrey Fell had Mac Miller, Rokeby. And you had a philosophy or an understanding, an approach to how you were going to get the best out of your horses. And a lot of times you would ride a two-year-old that you'd been working, you were familiar with, and not that you were holding them, not that you weren't trying to win, but it was much more important. P.G. Johnson was huge with this, that they got a good experience, they got a good run, that they had a race they could build off of, not tear them down. So you might finish third, fourth, fifth, close well, they got some dirt in their face, they got, bumped around a little bit in between horses, but they saw a lot of different situations within the race, And then they came running. They didn't get hit with the crop, and they you know, finished with energy, and you let them gallop out, and then you took your time coming back. And the whole overall experience was a good experience for them, and it was something to build on, and that would help create a better horse for a career. But what has happened over time is now, as jockeys, and jockeys do it the other way. So I'm not saying that it's owners and trainers. Jockeys do it as well. Everybody's just trying for the instant gratification of, if I'm a jockey, I want to ride the best horse on, you know, this day. Not that this could be a better horse in the future. Who's the best horse today? And then the trainers and owners are like, well, okay, you know, well, Mig was sixth in the standings. We could get, you know, Jerry Bailey's first. So, in essence, you're doing the right thing for the horse, setting him up for a better career, schooling him properly. And then if you're replaced, and, you know, I'm just throwing out names. This isn't, you know, I don't mean to, like, point anybody out, but Mike Smith, you know, has now got the mount. He wins on him. What's my motivation to do the right thing, because I don't get the reward at the end? Yeah, I helped you create a better horse, but I'm not there. I went to the proverbial funeral, and I didn't get to go to the wedding, right? So now I'm less inclined to ride horses in a way that, like, basically my thought is, well, I got to get the best out of this horse today, because I'm probably not going to ride him back anyway. And the same thing, but again, loyalty goes both ways. So I'm not just pointing out owners and trainers. Now, right, you've got a jockey. Hey, the horse ran great. You want to ride me? Yeah, but I can ride this really good one for Chad Brown. You know what I mean? Like, I think it was better for the horses when you had combinations of owners, trainers, jockeys that worked intimately together. I think it created better horses. I think horses had more longevity. I think that's when you saw horses string together multiple victories more, because they were prepared in a way that set them up for a career, not a race.
Well, part of that gets back into one of the topics that was discussed in recent weeks, which and comes up now it's been coming up for several years, but the whole, you know, the whole concept of win percentage and the detriment that it's been overall, because, you know, if your win percentage now in terms of attracting potential new owners, you know, if your win percentage isn't up to snuff, when you know, old school trainers and even old school handicapping, nobody was worried about that. It was such an obscurity, and then all of a sudden, when it starts showing up, you know, as part of stat package in PPs, it's become a problem. And so instead, you got people that are training horses that working out seven times for one start, as opposed to, you know, running three times over the same period.
Well, that's a great point. I mean, you think about, you know, years ago, like guys like Walter Kelly, you know, oh, he didn't win with first-time starters. You know, they would run fourth or fifth, you know, maybe more than once or twice, and then they would, you know, smoke them, right? Except, you know, once a year, he would, you know, I remember riding for him, and he would come to the paddock, and you're thinking, well, you know, get a nice run to this baby. No, this one will win today. Like, that's the first time he cracked you that this is the day. And, you know, he'd cash his bet, and the horse would win. And, you know, he had that horse cranked to win, and he knew the kind. He knew the kind of horse that could handle that pressure, the ones that were precocious enough, that had the right mind. You know, we always talk about horses from a physical perspective, how talented they are. A lot of horses are talented. A lot of, you know, from a physical perspective, they're fast, they're good. They don't have the mental capacity to handle the pressure of it, and they never fulfill their promise because they defeat themselves from a mental standpoint. They you know, it's like people. Listen, my wife was a really good runner in high school. She ran against Mary Decker Slaney, is it? Or
yep, Mary Decker Slaney.
Like a, yeah, and you know, Carmella was in the same league with her. She'd wash out. She talks about it. She said, I would start washing out the day before the race, and the nervous energy, my stomach would get going, I couldn't sleep. you know, and the other girl would show up with all this confidence and dudes. Horses and people, there's so many similarities. I mean, I really, the only difference between horses and people is that a horse will never hide his true character from you. If a horse is lazy, he's lazy, and there it is. If he's mean, he's mean. If he's generous, he's generous. He doesn't have an agenda. He's not trying to portray himself as one thing or herself as one thing and is actually another. That's the only difference. The horse has no agenda. They're pure. They are what they are. And you just have to be able to look at them and understand, okay, I get it. This is who you are. And you talk about, you know, people talk about horse whisperers. This is horse listeners. Just pay attention and listen to their body language and how they go about things. But I remember going to the track. I left Hemp Hill Farm. I was 14. I went to Belmont with one of the assistants for Walter Kelly, a guy named Casey. And I don't know. To this day, I don't know his last name. And I left Hemp Hill Farm, and I got there, and I, you know, wanted to get a galloping job, but Mr. Kelly wouldn't take me on because he already had Bobby Thibault as his apprentice. And so, but he said, I'll give you a hot walking job until you can find a galloping job. So I had the room there in the indoor barn. He was where Alan Jerkins wound up, and walking horses for him. But I've got $25 until payday. So I've got to make $25 last for 6 or 7 days. And then I think I was getting $80. And I was nervous about it. And the guy, Casey, said, hey, we're running a horse tomorrow named Bell's Gold. He says, the last race, George Martens rides him. He'll win. He said, how much money do you have? I said, I have $25. He says, you bet that $25 to win. It was a first-time starter. And I'm going, man, but if the horse loses, you know, I gotta make it to the end of the week. So I went across the street to the Talk of the Town deli. I bought a loaf of bread and a jar of peanut butter for like $5. So I'll bet the 20, and if the horse loses, at least I can eat until the end of the week. I'll survive. Well, the horse won and paid like $17, and I knew one of the mutual clerks who was an exercise rider in the morning. He put the bet in for me. I got $170. I'm flush. And the next day, Casey said to me, hey, did you bet that 25, you know, on the horse? And I was honest. Yeah, I was 14 years old. I was pure as spring rain. I was like, oh, no, I bought a jar of peanut butter and a loaf of bread in case he got beat, and I bet the 20 to win. Guy got mad at me. He said, I'll never give you another horse again. You didn't trust me. He was actually mad at me.
You did okay. The mad that you didn't bet the whole 25, you mean?
Yeah, because he thought that I didn't have confidence in his opinion that I hedged, so to speak.
That's funny
because I was hungry. I didn't want to go hungry. But you know, it's funny. Like I hear people talk about gambling and stuff, and I'm not a big bettor. See, like if I bet, you know, 50 to win on a horse or something, or you know, if I make a multi-race ticket, which I've gotten a little bit more involved in, you know, it's not for a lot of money. I'm just not comfortable betting a lot of money because I just don't think I'm that good at it. But you want to talk about like in ratio of what it means to you? That $20 was the biggest bet I ever met in my life.
Sure,
in my life.
Sure.
You know, because you think about the ramifications if it didn't work out, right?
Exactly. Exactly right. I mean, that's the element. You know, and Bell's Gold, of all horses, that was a nice horse, Bell's Gold.
Well, he was a really good horse. And, you know, the aside to this story, so I worked for Walter for, you know, a week or so. Mike Daggett was one of the assistants. I actually, Mike would come out to the farm at Hemp Hill Farm when I was still working there, and he had a couple horses out there, and I would see him coming, and I had my horse, some of my horses were like in the hollow, and I would go to, you know, I'd be up in the other barn, for some reason, I had 8 horses to rub, and they were like in 4 different barns, right, on the farm off of Hageman's Lane. And I would see Mike Daggett coming, and his 2 horses were down in a little barn in the hollow. So it's summertime. I would jump the fence. I'd run down there with fly spray and a rub rag, and I'd, you know, spray him down with the fly spray and rub them with the rub rag. Like, I'm like, that's all I was doing all day, right? Like, I was just down there wiping these horses with fly spray, and he would always give me $5. Well, when you're making $35 a week, room and board, $5 is like a nice supplement to your income. Every single time I'd see Mike Daggett coming, I'd jump the fence, run down there, spraying the horses down. He'd come up with $5. It was the greatest gig ever. Then the aside to it was, now I hooked on with Steve DeMauro, and I started galloping for Steve. You know, now I had papers that said I was 16. I was only 14. We go to Hialeah for the winter. You know, and I remember my grandfather making Steve promise he was going to get me in school down at Hialeah, because I had just, you know, I was only gone, finished the eighth grade, and I went to a couple months of ninth grade, taking three buses after galloping horses to go to afternoon session at school. But when we left for Hialeah, you know, now I'm out of school, and my dogs are going to start barking, because this is the new way to Christmas shop. Here comes FedEx and Amazon and all this. But I'm going to go on the other thing. So we get down to Hialeah, and I'm roommates with Tony Milan, who, you know, Johnny Velasquez's valet, in Barn P at Hialeah. And who's right behind us but Walter Kelly? And Bell's Gold was, like, had shown he could really run, and he was getting ready for, like, the Widener. And our tack room was right behind his stall. And my boss said, oh, Eddie Maple's coming to work a horse. So I ran to get tack and set the tack for Eddie Maple, and, you know, I'm excited because Eddie Maple's going to work a horse for us, and I think I might have even been working the horse with Eddie, you know, in company. And as I'm coming out of the tack room with the saddle and the bridle and admittedly excited, you know, Tony stuck his foot out and tripped me. So I kicked him, and he hit me with a tie chain, and back then the tie chains weren't covered in rubber. They were an actual chain. And he hit me with this tie chain, and I saw red. I was the raging bull at that moment, and I ran him up into the tack room, and I tackled him, and I started just wailing away and throwing punches, and you know, he was bigger than me, so I got some good shots in. But now he peeled me off him, and he's trying to hit me, and thankfully I was ducking and dodging. He hit the wall, he hit the feed sack, and then they pulled us apart. And one of my grooms, Ricky, was a dear friend of mine to this day, one of his great grooms from Virginia. Meanwhile, I got off, like, Tony never actually got to hit me. He would have killed me if it would have kept going. Said, if I ever see you pick on this kid again. Meanwhile, his nose was bloody, and his shirt was all, like, pulled out of shape. And but after training, Walter Kelly grabbed me. He said, I need to talk to you, son. And he said, you know, I have a really good horse in the stall behind the tack room. He goes, and he's getting ready for the Widener. And he acted up because you guys were fighting in behind and banging into the wall. He goes, what if my horse got hurt this morning? He said, I'm going to tell you right now, you have a future in this game, but you better conduct yourself like a gentleman and show more class than that. He said, if I ever see you acting like that again, he said, I'm personally going to put my foot in your ass. And it made such an impact on me. Like, I felt so bad, like I had let him down, because he actually gave me my first job on the track in reality. And it made a huge impression, and I really tried, because I was a little bit rough around the edges at that point, like really rough around the edges at that point. But it made a big impact on me. It genuinely did. And I really, at that time, I realized people were actually paying attention to me, and that, wow, maybe I do have a future. Like, people are seeing something in me, you know?
Yeah. Wow. This is what, you know, this is why these conversations are so much fun, because you venture into an area like that. I love it.
But, you know, isn't it funny, right? We're talking about what's best for the horses and how the old school horsemen used to approach it, and Michelle Nevin, and like how it all tied in, and it brought back this memory of Bell's Gold, and, you know, how he was, you know, kind of woven through the fabric, particularly early part of my career. And, you know, Steve, Mr. DeMauro, had some meet that winter at Hialeah. We were leading trainer. We beat Alan Jerkins. The last day, we had a horse called Morning Frolic that beat a horse of Hobos. And Alan's, like, a neck in the last I guess it was like the last race we both ran. We were tied going into it. And I remember, you know, because I'd have to cool the horses out after the races and stuff. And we were coming back from the receiving barn past Allen's barn. And we were all, you know, so excited and thrilled. And I think we had all bet on Morning Frolic. And that was the first time I ever saw Allen lose his temper. You know, he was, you know, because he was so competitive and emotional, and he was kicking buckets and he was firing everybody as we were going by the barn. And I only knew him from like playing touch football with him up in the chute at Hialeah. And I was like looking at Ricky, my buddy, rubbed Morning Frolic, and I was like, Rick, what's going on? He goes, that's just the chief, you know.
Exactly. We can get Chuck in here. Chuck will give you, he can give you a chapter and verse on that without a doubt.
Well, everybody he fired that it went like when we were going by was at work the next day. So
exactly. Yeah. If you were new, somebody would just, you would say, just come tomorrow. No, don't worry about it. It'll be forgotten. Couple of other things to slip in here. You know, last week, Rich, and in fact, I just got an email that I can feather this in about the bug girl at Oaklawn, who had I guess she's okay. Kylie Jordan, but I brought up with you Ailsa Morrison last week, and she got her first win in New York on Friday for Marvin Richards, and I had told you that I was impressed with the way she handled that horse the week before that runner. I know you ain't talking to me for Falcone. Just got beat. Yep. in a photo. I reached out to her. I'm going to try to. I thought it'd be fun to have her on the show. But nice for her to get a win in New York. And the question that came, our friend Nick Cirillo. I'm going to assume that race was on the air yesterday. Did you know the one I'm talking about? That. Where she, it looked to me like it was a heel clipping, and yeah, she got dropped mid stretch.
Yeah, but you know, it was odd too. It's like there's like a shadow there, and they kind of emerge out of that shadow. And I really didn't see the incident. I saw her, you know, trying to stay on, so I didn't see her actually clip heels because I kind of lost in the shadow, you know, and I didn't have a chance to go back and watch it again. You know, we were on air, Lafitte, you know, Greg Wolf's on vacation, and he's in England, and Lafitte was in, and, you know, always great to work with Lafitte, and, I mean, he's just such a talent. I mean, and I feel such a chemistry with him when we're on. You know, honestly, he and Scott Hazelton were the first people I was ever really teamed up with to do TV, and taught me so much, and you know, I still feel that connection, and he knows how to tee you up so well. I mean, so does Greg as well, but you know, I just have this history with Lafitte, and you know, so it was great working with him over the weekend, and we're going to be back together New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, and the day after. That's actually the next shows that I'm on, but I guess the next shows we're doing, but you know, watching that and Caddo River was like another thing. We had a lot to talk about. I mean, there were a lot of incidents, and frankly, when things happen like that, it actually gives me an opportunity to shine a little bit, to really talk about and dig into, you know, stuff that goes on.
Sure.
That the Stallion Stakes, when Dave Donk's horse and Tony Dutrow's horse came together, Jorge Vargas, names are escaping me. I'm sorry.
Gino and Unoho.
Yeah. And, you know, Trevor McCarthy's on the outside. And now, you know, my son works for Trevor McCarthy. I'm, of course, I'm rooting for them. I'm also on air. My responsibility is to report, not to you know, show my rooting interest. And, you know, when I watched and they came together, you know, my honest opinion. Unoho took a step in with Trevor, and the other horse took a step out, and it didn't warrant any kind of change in the order of finish. You know, as much as I would have loved to have seen it reversed. I mean, it would have been a big win for them. They came together, and it was a little bit of both. They both, you know, it was 50-50 as far as I was concerned, and they did the right thing, and they left it alone. But then you watch Caddo River yesterday, and when we had, like, this low shot that wasn't a true true head-on, and it almost looked like on that maybe Atoka, Wayne Lucas Source, might have taken a step out. But then when you see a true head-on, you see that Caddo River hit him in the hip and turned him out. And that's what people sometimes, I think, get lost. They don't realize that when horses are running straight, if they get hit in the right hip, it's going to point them, their shoulder, to the right. So, you know, it's like, you know, they're a 1,000-pound animal, like 18-wheeler. You know, if their hip goes to the left, their shoulder's going to go to the right. And it had to come down. I mean, I think it was one of those things where it was a great effort from Caddo River. It pointed out that he is matured even more. He looked bigger and stronger to me, and he rated uncomfortably at early. He was ranked. But he did show another dimension, because that's the first time he's ever actually rated and finished in first, even though ultimately he was disqualified. It was a shame. He was the best horse. But that was, I think, a warranted disqualification. And I think the stewards at Oaklawn have made it clear that they're holding these guys to a higher standard, and they'll get it. You know, that might not have come down in another jurisdiction, but that's what you have to know as a rider. What's acceptable here? What can I get away with here? What I better not try to get away with here? And I think that's one of those that Florent Drew would like to have over, because every time he went at him with his right-handed crop, he had to correct him. And that's a huge pet peeve of mine. If you're having to constantly correct a horse, you're slowing him down at the same time. You know, I saw somebody get beat in head in the last race the other day at Aqueduct. Hit right-handed, drift in, grab him. Hit right-handed, drift in, grab him. Well, aren't you sending six mixed messages? You want them to go forward, but then you're constantly correcting them. If you're correcting, you're slowing them down.
I'm glad you brought up the Caddo River, because there was certainly a lot going on in that race, and it kind of demonstrates how and why it's so difficult to draw the rail. And the potential that it offers for issues, because, Giroux had nothing but headaches, until he got out, it was just a nightmare. And I don't blame anybody, any of the riders that were, you know, continually keeping him pinned in while they were also, you know, gaining their own position. Atoka most notably. I actually picked Atoka in there, and I was a little surprised to get put up. I did not think it was an automatic takedown.
Yeah, but if you saw, there was a DQ. Kelsey Haar got taken down. Yep. Maybe opening day or second day. You know, you watch that DQ and the angles that they were able to show with that. And placed her behind a horse, I think ultimately finished last. They set the tone right there. They basically said to the jocks room, you guys are going to ride clean or you're going to pay the price. I mean, they threw down the gauntlet, as far as I'm concerned, with that DQ. Because that one I wouldn't have taken it down from the views I got to see. I just thought there was too much gray area. And the fact of the matter is, because we're used to how they adjudicate things in New York, that if they don't feel like it costs a horse a placing, they'll leave it up. You know, you would almost expect that they would have said, okay, we're going to leave it up, but Kelsey, we're going to give you 3 days or, you know, whatever. You know, knowing how things are adjudicated in any given jurisdiction is critical. And I think after that DQ, they set the tone. And as long as they're consistent with it, and this was consistent with that DQ as well, Caddo River. He was the best horse. Make no mistake about that. But they have laid down the law. And as long as they continually and consistently apply that way, then you have no beef with it. That's where I used to get upset when I was riding. You know, wait, I got run over at the eighth pole on Saturday and nothing happened. And wait, now you're taking me down on Wednesday for something that I don't even think was comparable. And that's when I would lose my mind about it. Like, consistency. Everybody just wants consistency.
And yeah, exactly.
You know, we talked about it last week. If you're consistent and riders of this class know where the line is, they won't run through that line. If they don't know where the line is, that's where it gets dangerous.
Yeah. 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 Interesting. I have no complaints because I benefited, but... I started to write something. I thought, you know what, this is, you know, whenever there's either a DQ or a non-call, there's a certain percentage that are going to be, annoyed, and a certain percentage that are going to be. I thought, what's the point? So I'm glad we had a chance to talk about it. There was. Well, for goodness sakes, I had one more. I had something else that I thought you could riff on. We just got a couple of minutes. Uriah St. Louis is going to join us at the top of the hour.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Man, Steve, you're showing some signs here.
No, that's for sure. And I've never had a concussion that I know of. That's usually Tony. That's Tony's. Tony, you say it too. We mentioned Gino and Unoho. The other stallion stake, that Yoka's second time starter, ran very well. In a morning matcha, I was left with a lot to do.
I was worried about that with her turning back from the races at Parks. You know, she went a mile, two turns, slow paced races. You know, that takes a little bit of speed away from horse. Not that she ever had any real speed, to speak of. And I thought that was the only way she could lose, if she just got out, left behind too much. But let's give Yoka's credit too, because her first race was really, really good. And I remember making notes that, this is a filly to bet back. And then I guess in my mind I had it like bet back in a maiden race. And then she's in the Stallion Stakes, which totally made sense. And it kind of threw me off the scent a little bit. Dreammaker Stable, Tom Gallo, nice to see them get a big win. I was Tom and I are friends. And he got interviewed, and Maggie had called him Bill Gallo like a month ago they won the race. And so I've been calling him Bill. And then the other day when we first reported about her winning, I didn't think we gave her or Dreammaker Stable enough props. And I think we've got to all be more conscious of giving the owner, breeder, owners and breeders more props. They've got so much heavily invested in this, and we're always talking about, definitely the jockey because they're in the front of the house, right? And then the trainer, and I think a lot of times we are negligent in giving the owners and the breeders their due, and that's something I want to be much more conscious of. That's like my 2022 what do they call that?
Resolution. Yeah, New Year's resolution.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of my resolutions, to do that. And then as much as possible, dig a little more into the grooms and the exercise riders, get names, I think we do our best and we try, but I think we can take it to another level, and making the effort to get a groom's name, get the exercise rider's name, give them the props. Talk to them. Some horses are very difficult.
Sure.
Get the inside story. Guys are getting on horses. Guys and girls are getting on horses at 5:30 in the morning, and grooms are there at 4:30 in the morning. And just to hear their name, I'm sure it's got to make them feel more appreciated. So that's definitely one of my resolutions going forward this year. And so when I was able to, I gave Tom more props and the horse more props, and But I was laughing. I was teasing that he probably feels like the Rodney Dangerfield of owners right now. But it was a nice win for them. The night I got engaged in Saratoga many, 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 many years ago, Carmelo and I went to dinner, and his dad, Tom's dad, wound up finding out that we had gotten engaged, and we wound up having this big party at the Wishing Well, and he picked up our tab, and then we wound up with all these people, and it was quite an evening.
That's cool. That's a nice memory. You mentioned the, the ownership side, and these two races, which are this is big money, and people think it's state breds. It's not state breds. This is a stallion program that is basically designed to showcase the stallions that are standing in New York, and very much like the Maryland Million races. It's not to prevent people from sending their mares to Kentucky to get covered, but it is designed to promote the stallions in state. That's the motivation of the Stallion Series.
Morning Match is a Pennsylvania bred. But she's by a New York Stallion. I won a Stallion Stakes years ago on Jersey Girl because she was by Belong to Me. She was a Jersey bred, but meanwhile, she's a grade one horse, and there were three or four maidens in there. And I remember thinking the only way she can lose is if she stumbled at the break and I fell off. I sat down on her back the first three strides in case she did stumble, because the only way she could lose is if I fell off. And I had seen Jacinto Vasquez do that years earlier when he was on a horse that was so much the best. He would actually sit on their back for a few strides instead of when you kind of pop up when they break. Could you imagine though what it feels like to ride Jersey Girl against a bunch of just okay New York breds? She's a multiple grade one winner.
Yeah, Todd's first, right? Todd's.
I remember so. Mike was riding. Mike Smith was riding for Todd, and he broke his collarbone at Gulfstream that winter on a horse of Todd's. And he had ridden Jersey Girl as a 2-year-old, and then I get to ride her first in the Stallion Stakes. Mike was out hurt, and then I rode her back in the Cicada, and she won. Oh man, she was really, really good. I mean, she was clipping along 44 and change with her ears up in the air and just having fun. And I was supposed to go work her. And I went to the barn to work her, and Mike was sitting in the office, and Todd said, "Hey," and we talked to you, and he said, "Listen, Mike was riding her before, and he got hurt on my horse, and I feel like I got to put him back on." And I was like, listen, that's the right way. I would hope that if it came back the same way, guys would do the same for me, that, you'd get your horses back. And I had no problem with it. And then she won the Acorn, the Mother Goose, the test. most of the time really didn't work out that way for me.
that's a pendulum that swings both ways. And before we wrap, when you talk about the breeding side, how about yesterday's oddity with the two stakes, both bred by the Prestons, by Prestonwood, both Forewarned and Chateau as well, that won the Gravesend, and both by Flat Out, and Flat Out had the winner of the opener. He had three winners on the card.
Huge. Absolutely.
Crazy.
Big accomplishment, too. And, being by Flatter, I think Flatter's, born out to be, a sire of sires, obviously. I mean, this is, I've always been impressed with Flatter's offspring, how they're just tremendous individuals from a physical perspective. They're really beautiful horses, really well-balanced, strong horses. And now Flat Out kind of passing that on too. Chateau, he's about as handsome a horse as you're going to see. And I grew up in Gravesend, so how about that?
Well, Flat Out is standing in I think Oklahoma now, but this was the craziest thing. I to have them, the two of them win those races, and then the one earlier on the card as well. So, well, Rich, send out some Christmas and New Year's greetings to everybody as we wrap up.
I will. Happy holidays to everybody, and to you and your family, Steve, and obviously all your listeners, all the racing fans out there. And now I got to go finish mucking stuff.
There you go. I gave you an hour respite away, and buckle up, and best to you and Mel and the kids. And we will talk. We'll talk on January 3rd.
Look forward to it.
Rich Migliori, everybody. Thanks, Meg. Mig4450 on your Twitter. Let's take the top of the hour break. Uriah St. Louis is going to join us from Philadelphia, and he can talk about coming to New York, winning another big stake. He's done it enough at this point. Back after this, hour three, Monday at the races, Sirius XM.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why in the past decade has BR